Okay, great. Well, thank you. So we have Dan and Marta, and is it just the two of you?
Yeah, yeah, Lucy isn't here today, yeah.
Okay, great. Yeah. So,
we've got 15 minutes.
All right, brilliant.
Discussion.
Okay, cheers. Yeah, so it's a joint paper. Marta's here to answer questions at the end if I get the thing completely messed up as well. Lucia's in Hong Kong, so she's not here today. So, international experiment in everyday exchanges. So the paper came out, you might have read the paper already, but it kind of came about through this anecdote that Lucia was talking to me about ages ago when we were having breakfast together at a conference. And I was talking about the difficulty of getting to grips with price, right? Like, you know, how do you get to grips with actually researching price and the complexities of where it happens? Because most times we don't really talk about price, we just buy things in supermarkets and so on. And she started telling me about this experience she'd had buying a cardigan in the Silk Street Market in Beijing, which is kind of apparently notorious for, you know, sort of fake designer goods, but also for its kind of bargaining strategies, right? It's very, very lively, noisy kind of place. Lots of kind of physical encounters going on that Lucia was talking about, you know, salespeople kind of, you know, directing you to one side to sort of, you know, give you a, you know, special offer of some kind, or people kind of walking away and feigning non-interest in the object and then kind of coming back later on. And these exchanges taking place over quite a long drawn-out period, right? So like one salesperson would potentially be dealing with several different customers who'd kind of were in a different stage of walking away and coming back, right? So it was kind of, the salespeople had to have quite a good sense of who the person was and what the previous price was that had been offered and so on. You know, she was kind of trying to buy this cardigan, but listening to all these exchanges that were going on and trying to figure out what her strategy should be for getting the best price. And people were getting special offers on various different bases. People were opening up their purses saying, oh, this is all the money I have. People were pointing to other markets where things were being priced differently. The traders themselves are talking about, you know, you need to take pity on us, we need to make a living. So it's always kind of work to point up things to hand, like the quality of goods, how handsome a person was, indexing all of these other sorts of places, you know, other prices, other markets, other customers that were getting the special deals, to create these kind of contrast structures, these kind of forms of presence and absence, these things that were there and not there. And timing seemed to be really important, right? You know, when to stand your ground, when to walk away, when to come back. And Lucia was trying to figure all this out, and one of the other shoppers said, you know, the kind of the rule for this is that you kind of keep doing this sort of walking away and see if the salesperson tries to follow you. And each time you go back, hopefully the price comes down a bit. And if you get to the point where the salesperson doesn't follow you, that's the point where you should buy, right? Because that's probably the lowest price you're going to get. So basically, it's a whole kind of unwritten rules of price negotiation. And I mean, obviously, the actual numerical price is kind of central to this. And so we thought, well, how can we go about getting to grips with pricing, the actual details of pricing itself, how it happens? And obviously, you know, we come from an STS kind of background, and there's this move from science and technology studies into social studies of finance, but tends to treat kind of prices in more or less formal ways, like financial type markets and things like that. And we wanted to look more at everyday pricing, so we couldn't find too many ideas there. The sociology and anthropology of sort of everyday studies of pricing is quite interesting for us, but you know, studies of auctions and studies of other kinds of car boot sales and garage sales and other things going on. It's okay, but sometimes price seemed a bit sidelined in some of those accounts somehow. In kind of experimental economics and behavioural economics, there are these sorts of ways of kind of keeping price central, but at the same time there's all these kinds of issues around what the kind of experimental setup assumes about the nature of people doing the pricing experiment. Right? Yes, the suggestion from these sorts of experimental economics approaches is that somehow they're kind of getting to grips with human nature, getting to grips with the kind of economic calculations that are somehow kind of intrinsic to the nature of people. So that seemed to kind of a whole series of kind of problematic assumptions in those experiments, but they did at least keep pricing centre stage. So we then started to think about, well, what kinds of experiments could we do? Right? What kinds of experiments might we do as kind of qualitative social scientists with an interest in STS that somehow don't carry on with some of these assumptions, don't carry over a kind of model of the natural sciences into the social sciences, don't have kind of control groups or variables to manipulate. So we looked to Garfinkel's breach experiments, where, you know, probably as you're aware, you know, Garfinkel would kind of look at an everyday sort of form of encounter and then try and kind of cause trouble and see what happened, and then treat the trouble that was caused as the basis for making sense of that particular kind of encounter.
So we'd send students home to their own houses and get them to act as lodgers in their own houses and record what happened. Like, people would be upset. People would say, you're not supposed to act like this, you're supposed to act like this. And then Garfinkel would analyse this as the basis for that kind of interaction order. But the bridge experiments themselves are kind of ethically considered kind of dubious. People weren't fully informed of the nature of the breach. People were, lots of distress was caused and anxiety and so on. None of which Garfinkel seems bothered about reflecting on in his publications. If you read the stuff about the breach experiments, he kind of seems to actually enjoy the anxiety caused. And so we thought, well, what kind of breach could we do in pricing that would be a bit more kind of gentle? So Marta and I set up these two selling experiments, one in Copenhagen at the Forum Flea Market, and then one in the UK in Oxford at a car boot sale, where we would act as sellers in those locations. And but instead of actually pricing up our goods, we'd leave off the prices, right? So what we assumed would be quite a gentle breach, okay? We'd leave off the prices, and then when potential customers came up to us to ask about the goods, we would get them to set the price and then give an account of why. Why were they setting the price as they did? So it seemed like quite a gentle breach, and it seemed like a way of kind of gathering data on how people set prices. Other than that, we didn't have any kind of grand hypothesis as to what we would find. So let's have a look at the two experiments. There's much more detail on this in the paper, of course. Martha actually got to do her experiment first before me. I was a bit slow getting mine going. So Forum Flea Market in Copenhagen. That photo that I showed you on the first slide is the Forum Flea Market there. So it's quite a large sort of setup thing. And you have to sort of pay to have a stall there, and it costs more depending on what location you're in, right? So there's a kind of pricing of the stalls as well. And so Marta tried to run the experiment, and you leave the prices off goods, get customers to come up, and then discuss what's going on. At least the first 10 customers, probably more, I was trying to count it for the transcript, walk away without saying much at all when they realise that there's no prices on the goods. Some of these seem kind of angry, but we're kind of not left with much data on that because they don't really talk to us, so they just walked away. So they seemed angry, but we're not really too sure on the nature and specificity of that anger or the type of walking away that they're doing. It just seems that they're just unhappy at the absence of prices. So then Martha tried to sort of do a sort of changing experiment, set some different prices, some high, some kind of close to what the goods cost in the first place, to see what would happen. And so what we kind of came up with in Copenhagen is that it seems like setting the price is not about setting the amount that someone will pay, but it's about putting a number on it which will open up a conversation, right? So the price is there to open up the conversation. So once Martha set some prices, people became very articulate and happy to kind of engage in conversations. I don't have time to read out all the transcripts, they're all in the paper. What people started to talk about was not just the price, but kind of like the unwritten rules of the flea market, right, and how those related to price. So people started to talk about things like, the price needs to be set at a level where they can then negotiate, right? So this person here talks about, they expect to pay, expect to open the bargaining something like half price. And the person here is talking about, if you'd said 20 kroner, then I thought that was too cheap and it's not worth the purchase. If you'd said 100, I thought it's too expensive, right? So it's not just about the absolute amount, it's about kind of the right kind of price and some sort of unwritten rules about setting that up. And it was also interesting that it turned out that there were all kinds of unwritten rules about the precise nature of the price. It had to be a kind of round number, okay? So when Martha tried to accidentally sell something for 37 kroner, the person just said, that's a weird price, and walked away. The person on the next door also joined in with the criticism, right, saying you cannot set that sort of price. And this customer here also talks about, you can't offer 37 and a half as someone buying a good. It's all about round numbers, 20, 30, 150. So it's quite interesting. Once Martha set the prices, then it opened up these conversations about kind of rights and wrongs of pricing. There seemed to be a kind of social moral order thing going on. Really? Oh, my God. Really good. Right, so, and then people would enter into all kinds of articulations about how to judge and set the price for goods, right? So people would talk about what they could perceive in the material kind of object itself, its history, its craftsmanship, collectability, where it might feature in the home in the future, what other kinds of objects it might displace, okay? So people would talk about this as a way of setting their price, right? This was their kind of reasoning for doing it. In contrast, the experiment of the car boot sale in Oxford, people were not so articulate as such. People didn't come up with these kind of long accounts and stuff, and there wasn't really that much focus on things like the unwritten rules of the boot sale, but just a little bit, right? So this person here says, I don't know, you tell me, this is the boot sale, you set the price, and then I agree, right? But they wouldn't really go into these kind of long articulations about it. Again, here I try to get the person to set the price. Oh no! I go and make an offer, and then nothing. What's your best offer? No. This is a boot sale. It could be 20p or £5. You tell me, right? So people wanted to kind of articulate a little bit the underdogs, but much less frequently than in Copenhagen. And pretty much no one walked away angry, as far as I could tell. Also, to some extent, people were kind of coming up with judgments for the goods, but nothing like the ones in Copenhagen. Like, nothing about kind of articulating the material properties of the goods, but just saying things like this. You know, someone picked up a toy microscope, and I said, what do you think? Do you like it? No. And he walks away. It's a very, very kind of quick, rapid-fire exchanges, which were very characteristic of the boot sale, it seemed to me. Like, just very, very quick settlement of various features, right? So, very quick settlement of whether certain types of goods were even on the stall, to the extent that the people doing the shopping wouldn't look at the things on the stall, they would ask me to account for what was on the stall. Right? So, got any records? No. Walk away. Got any old cameras? No. Walks away. Got any collectible toys? I don't think so. Walks away. Right? So very, very kind of rapid settlement of is there something there that's even worth negotiating for?
Oxford is a rough place.
I'll send you the transcript. You can read the whole thing. It's quite... Yeah, there were some features of the experiment which were not too easy. People are entering into negotiations right now. It's a boot sale where it seems like the prices are really, really low, much lower than Copenhagen. We could talk a bit about that afterwards, but also price settlement was really quick. There were no kind of long drawn out negotiations. There were no kind of three or four stage negotiations. It was all very quick. So like people would say things like, how much? They wouldn't even name the object. I'd just pick up, how much? And I'd say, what do you think? And try and articulate the terms of the experiment. 50p, and I'd say a pound. Yes, that's it, right? Price settled. And then they'd kind of pay, and that was it. Or people go for a kind of middling kind of strategy where, you know, the price would be settled somewhere in the middle. Or people would go for a price settlement strategy where they would try and kind of reassure me that the price was okay. So, right, first, very, very typical in exchanges, woman picks up a pot and says, pot? And then things like, how much is the pot? Or, nice day, pot? What do you think? 20p. Really? Yes, it's okay. Okay. That's the end of the exchange. She then picked up two and gave me 40p. That's the end of the exchange. It's a very, very quick price settlement. The same sort of thing happens here. What do you think it's worth? £1.50. And then I try and kind of get this negotiation going on around the brand name, Marks and Spencers. And, you know, the woman sort of doesn't respond to that at all. She just kind of sticks to the same price. So, concluding. What we found, I think, in the experiments is that there's some, I think, interesting features of pricing. This issue of movement or not, you know, kind of the movement and non-movement of people and goods, is different in each different location. In Beijing, there was this kind of quite physical movement of people walking away, people coming back. In Oxford at the boot sale, people moving rapidly from stall to stall to stall, like checking if things were there or not. This idea of presence and absence also played out differently in different locations. You know, people would point to things that were very close to hand or point to other locations for prices, and timing was different in each place. So Copenhagen seemed to have quite a relaxed kind of temporality to it, and the boot sale in Oxford, very, very quick, very kind of rapid-fire exchanges. So quite different sorts of forms of order. Beijing was very price kind of focused, even if the negotiations went on over a number of times. No one really said anything that was outside of a kind of price negotiation tactic, or somehow still directed towards what the price would be. In Copenhagen, you know, we had this kind of series of potentially maybe angry customers at the start, but also once they entered into engagement with the goods, it was quite kind of articulate sorts of descriptions, and not always quite so focused or pointed towards price as such, but kind of, you know, other features of their life and other things that were going on. It seemed a bit more conversational. Oxford, it was these rapid exchanges, rapid fire exchanges to settle price or to even to settle the kind of presence or absence of goods. And then I guess the other conclusion that we want to kind of explore a bit more is this kind of methodological conclusion about what do we make of kind of qualitative, I call them real-time, real-place experiments. I don't know if that's really a good term for it, but sort of engaging with the world out there, not trying to do a kind of simulated experiment like experimental economics might do. But doing it sort of in real time, seeing what happens. Very, very hard work, it turned out. I think we both agree it was super hard work. I'm going to probably try and do another couple of boot sales to see if we can kind of increase the data a bit. It did enable this kind of very up-close engagement with price. And the breach experiment itself seemed to be kind of treated mostly, I think, as a kind of gentleish breach. Yeah, although maybe there was some anger in Copenhagen. And now we're just kind of looking at maybe doing some other forms of qualitative experiment with other kind of economic type activities. That's it, I shall stop there.
So the boot sale thing is something that I had never done before I came to this country. And
yeah.
I'm a big fan of it.
Yeah.
So I have a few questions.
Yeah.
You were a man selling.
Mm.
Do you think gender played a role at all in how you kind of postured your performance?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to know in a way, isn't it? Because I'm trying to sort of be a bit reflexive on it. Not so much in the paper, but kind of when we were thinking about things like the themes of the analysis and stuff. And also things like the sort of balance of customers, where I ended up with far more female customers than male customers. Could sort of speculate for different reasons why that might be. And I don't have a kind of statistical breakdown of how many shoppers there were in the car boot sale in Oxford that day, right? So I couldn't say if it was proportionate or disproportionate or anything else. Certainly, the features that we have picked out here were common across customers, whether they were male or female, like the rapid fire price. My particular gender being a man, I don't know. I mean, people would sort of, I was selling some building material. We had some building work on the house, and there was some building materials left over now. So I was selling some building materials. I don't know anything about building materials, right? And I was not doing any of the building work. I just had it left over. It's so like this kind of weird exchange about this radiator where the guy starts asking me questions about things like the valves on the radiator and stuff, and I don't know what he's talking about. So I just have to kind of answer him whatever way I can. I don't know if there's a kind of gendered component to that. You know, if people, because I'm a man or something, people would expect me to know more about it. I don't know. I'm not sure. The range of goods on sale was quite broad, from building materials through to children's old toys to other things as well. So I don't think there was a particular kind of gender, sort of gendered set of objects that were on sale as such. Didn't
was
sort
it
of
the same on all sites, or did it differ in Copenhagen?
So in Copenhagen, what were you selling, Marta? Some stuff that you'd bought at another flea market.
Because the weekend before, I went to another flea market outside, so I followed a seller to understand how the flea market was working. So she was explaining what she was doing, to buy items there that were cheaper to bring to Copenhagen. So I followed. And I think that the gender composition is, half and half. Doesn't really. It's matter more of age, because mm-hmm. there are much more older persons and pensioners that are going there and they are attending rather than young people.
Yeah, there's some other issues about types of seller at the booth sale which we don't talk about. But what I picked up on and kind of trying to start some conversations with other sellers is that some of them are very, very regular, right? Very regular sellers. And so there are these kind of issues of trust around, if they're selling things like CDs or DVDs, are those going to work or not? And if they're a regular seller, they're more trusting. I wasn't really selling anything like that. And then most of those collectors that came along and said, have you got any of the very specific items? They seemed like boot sale regulars that would go to more than one boot sale a day quite often. So they would go around all the stores very quickly to try and find stuff that they were interested in. And so different sorts of
questions. Okay, I hope you don't mind, but maybe if we take two questions, because we have four to get through in 4 minutes.
Oh, sorry,
so
okay,
we
very quick
two in the front.
Right. Some of the things you've highlighted in the paper are quite normal boot sale practices.
Mm.
So, my first question is, did you go to a boot sale that was recurring, or is it a one off? And you also mentioned the people who went around with the torch, and you speculated that these might be because they go to multiple sales.
Yeah.
We can talk later about how I know this, but this is called the pre-sale period in some kind of pre-sales, and you get the people who are going to sell later in that market who go around very quickly to see who's got what. They usually work in a team of two. You get one person who goes around with a torch and says, do you have this? And the other person is setting up their stall. And those they often have a recurring thing. You see this also at Port Bella Road. So I'm interested in whether the boot sale is recurring or not, and how you think that impacts on price.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is a regular boot sale, although I'm not a regular attendee at it, has to be said. I thought it was horrible, to be honest, but it was freezing cold, it was dark, it was like 7:30 in the morning in January. I'd be like, why are you holding the boots out at this time? No one can.
Right,
and you're like selling goods for like 20p a go and stuff. What's going on? Anyway, it was super popular, right? They said, don't get there before 7:30 because we don't open the gates till then. When I got there, it was full. Right,
it's because of the pre-sale trading period.
Yeah, but it's like the gates don't even open to it. But pre-sale stuff, it's a regular boot sale. Pre-sale stuff, to some extent, those people that were going around with the torches, I couldn't figure out if... I mean, I think it was business-oriented, right? They're gathering stuff to sell. I don't know how many of them were selling at that boot sale or other boot sales. So in the... within a... I don't know, like... 5-mile radius sort of around Oxford. There's several boot sales that go on a Sunday, so I don't know if they were selling at that one or a different one. In the Copenhagen flea market, there's a kind of organised pre-sale, right? So you have you have professional sellers downstairs and non-professional sellers upstairs, but on the first day, the public aren't allowed in, and the professional sellers go around the other people's stalls to try and find stuff.
That's quite common in
these bigger... But that's a 3-day sale, which I forgot to mention,
I really enjoyed that. I thought it was fascinating work. I wanted to ask you something about the nature of the objects, because in your account they sounded quite sort of lacking in vitality, a bit, I mean maybe that's the nature of the boot sale, but kind of quite deadened. And it struck me that other spaces, especially say an antique market, or I'm going to talk about fish market in a moment, there's a different kind of relationship to the object, and that would produce a different kind of conversation and maybe a more sustained exchange.
Yeah, so we've been thinking about this. So like, is there a difference between the flea market in Copenhagen, where the sorts of objects on sale would include things like more collectibles, antiques and stuff like that? The boot sale, there is probably... I think I saw two stalls, but this might be just this particular boot sale, but two stalls that were selling things that were more like antiques, and I wouldn't guarantee the sort of veracity of those, but they look more like antiques from where I was standing. So it's not very common, because there's probably about 60 stalls there or something, so you know, a very small percentage was selling those kinds of things. So it might be that the characteristic of the boot sale is more oriented towards kind of those everyday objects. That certainly seemed to be the case. It would be interesting to repeat the experiment in other locations, or even to take other sorts of objects to the boot sale to see what happens to them. And I also kind of realised afterwards that my price setting negotiation was not as extravagant as I could have tried, right? You know, people say 50p and I should say something like, no, £10, right? Or just sort of, they say 50p and I say no, 20p or something, you know, just to kind of play around with it a bit more. I hadn't really, you know, it was going really fast actually. But I really kind of thought through in advance, how am I going to do that negotiation to try and bring out different sorts of points of view? But I think it would be possible to repeat it and try those sorts of tactics. Yeah.
Yes, so I'm afraid we have to end it there, so maybe you can continue the discussion for the other questions afterwards. Thank you.
Of course.
So next up we have Millie.
Okay. Hi, my name is Millie. I'm from the University of Virginia. This paper kind of sort of is an